Welcome to the Dandelion Effect Podcast, a space for organic conversation about the magic of living a connected life. Just like the natural world around us, we are all linked through an intricate web, a never-ending ripple that spans across the globe. Here, we explore the ideas that our guests carry through the world, remember who and what inspired them along the way, and uncover the seeds that help them blossom into their unique version of this human experience. This podcast is a production of the Feathered Pipe Foundation, whose mission is to help people find their direction through access to programs and experiences that support healing, education, community, and empowerment. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Dandelion Effect Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Vantrese, and today I'm speaking with Chef Claudia Cravat. Claudia is a chef, writer, an ambassador with Ola Montana, and a lover of all things culture, food, and community. She was born and raised in Barranquilla, Colombia, a tropical city on the country's northern Caribbean coast, where she grew up primarily with her aunt and uncle. But not long after she turned 18, she moved to Miami and pursued a degree in sociology and international relations, met Steve, her now husband of 42 years, and kind of worked her way through nonprofit organizations, human resource positions, and a couple different chef roles, trying to find her niche in helping people and having an impact. But when they moved to Bozeman, Montana in 1998, she had one main concern. What the heck is a Caribbean girl going to eat in the Rocky Mountains? Luckily, she did find plantains, coconuts, and lentils, the colorful varieties from timeless seeds grown organically right here in Montana. Now, if you've been listening to this podcast, you know that we interviewed Timeless Seeds co-founder Jim Barngrover a while back, and that the Feathered Pipe Ranch uses Timeless Seeds lentils, chickpeas, and ancient grains. And this summer, our guests have tasted the difference in how delicious food can be as we've gotten to serving 98% organic and 75% local at the retreat center. So discovering lentils in Montana, which was a staple food in Colombia, gave Claudia the confidence to begin recreating recipes from her childhood using local and homegrown ingredients. Through her love of fusion foods, Claudia has built a business as a private chef, leading cooking classes, hosting pop-up dinners, catering large events, and always looking for new and exciting ways to collaborate with local farmers, creators, and chefs of different backgrounds. Claudia and I recorded this interview live in Bozeman, Montana, where we both live, and I had the absolute pleasure of eating a homemade lunch at her house prior to this conversation. She made arepas, a simplified pozole with hominy and pork, and her famous green salsa, which she's going to start selling locally soon. Spending an afternoon with her, I quickly realized why the tagline of her business, Claudia's Mesa, is One World, One Table. Her work and energy center around celebrating life and strengthening relationships. Relationship to the foods we eat, the stories we exchange, the cultures that shaped us and the ones we're continually learning more about, and the relationship with each other as we come to the table and break bread together. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation and help me welcome my friend, Chef Claudia. So you were born in Barranquilla, mm-hmm. in Colombia, which is on the Caribbean coast,
yep.
in 1955. And I want to ask you about your origin through the lens of food. You know, what do you remember about being a young girl mm-hmm. in Colombia, and what smells, and what was the market like, and what were the staple foods that you ate all the time?
As a child, I didn't really know that a lot of the food that we ate in Colombia's Caribbean coast is influenced by Nigerian Yoruba. If you look at a globe and you look where Nigeria is, and then you see the path that the slave ships would bring, slaves coming from there versus in the Pacific coast of Colombia, they would be coming from the other side of Africa. So you have all the different people in Colombia that once from one region look totally different from others. Mm-hmm. The colors of their skin is different, the music and the food, because it comes from a different part of Africa. I didn't know any of that. I just loved to eat it. So a lot of the food that I ate also had to do with the crops and the fruits that we grew. There's a story about the city of Barranquilla, which Barranca means a gorge, and Illa is the diminutive for something. So Barranquilla is a little gorge.
Okay.
And it was discovered by the cows. And then the people that were looking for their cows follow them because there was a drought and the cows could not get anything to drink. And they settled in this barranca, in this gorge, which is right at the mouth of the Magdalena River. The Magdalena River, besides having such a beautiful name, comes all the way from the Andes. So it goes up the mountains and then empties out in on the ocean.
Wow.
So I grew up with my aunt Alicia. The Alicia was my dad's sister. And because my mom and my dad were in constant bickering and they separated, and they were the black sheep of the family. They came from a very large family. My mom was the seventh and my dad was the sixth. And each set of grandparents had their history. On my dad's side, my grandmother was Sephardic. And in the persecution of the Jews in Spain, they fled through the island of Curaçao, where my dad ends up working.
Okay.
Curaçao has the largest synagogue in the entire America. So on my dad's side, my grandmother came from that end, and my grandfather was Spanish from Catalonia, bordering with France. So my last name is Galofre, which sounds very French.
Mm-hmm.
And then on my mother's side, my grandfather came from a beautiful Tuscan little town named Lucca, which is the capital of the olive oil. And then on my grandmother's side, her family came from Cuba. She was born in Colombia, but they were Cuban, but Cuba was very Spanish. Cuba was the last Latin American country to become independent of Spain.
Mm.
And it was close to the 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
Colombia was 1881, United States 1776, we were 1881. I grew up with my tia Alicia, and I lived in this amazing house that was the color of a ginger cookie. We used to call it the gingerbread colored house. And my bedroom was on the second floor. So all the houses were like this colonial style. They had like French shutter doors. You know, we didn't have windows. It was all white shutters,
mm-hmm.
like very colonial looking that you open up. No AC. We had ceiling fans. And I would be woken up every morning before sunrise by our neighbor's black rooster. And open the window and you see all of my patio with fruit trees. And there were mango trees, lemon trees, grapefruit, huge papaya tree with these big papayas hanging. I used to say it was like a big tall lady with big earrings.
Because yeah.
That's what they looked like.
Yeah.
And then there was the guava tree right in the middle. And the one you could smell the most was the guava. We had coconut trees as well. But the coconut trees made it into like a yellow state. You know, you have to pull them out like that. Then you get that part out. Then you have the brown nut. There were no appliances to help us grate coconut.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to take that coconut, you had to go with a machete and go outside to the patio by the tile. So Mama Esco cut it with the machete. First she would open a couple of holes. The coconuts have like three little holes.
Mm-hmm.
And then she would take the coconut, put it over a glass so all the coconut water would come out, which she would then use for the coconut rice, for example.
Right.
So then she'd open the coconut, then bring it back, and then she would grate it by hand, no food processor. So she had taught me that, and I remember just messing up my little fingers mm-hmm. from doing that. Breakfast was very simple for us women. For us women was café con leche, coffee, you know, milk and coffee. Café con leche and papaya, always a fresh fruit, something from that basket that was in the kitchen. And then a piece of queso fresco, that was it. But the guys, they would have like scrambled eggs with like five eggs, you know, just this.
Just what, getting more protein or?
That's just how it was. Just a lot of protein. Colombia is a lot like Montana. We didn't do bacon, so they would have butifarras, which are like a little sausage.
Mm-hmm.
I would eat eggs like on the weekend. I just wasn't interested. You know, I'd rather have bread with guava jam on it
mm-hmm.
and cheese.
Something sweet.
Fresh fruit. So lunch, there was always rice. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we had yuca and plantain with the rice. That's why you had to go take a siesta. A ton of meat, beans, not black beans, that's more Cuban and Mexican, but we had a lot of white beans and a lot of kidney beans.
Okay.
A lot of plantains, a lot of yuca, a lot of soups, even though it was so hot there. We had sancochos, we had shrimp soup, fish soup, all sorts of seafood. And every Friday for the 18 years I lived there, we never ate meat because it was a day to observe Jesus and the crucifixion because he died on a Friday. So as good Latin Catholics, all these myths around that if you eat meat, you're eating Jesus' flesh.
Only on Fridays.
Only on Fridays. So there was always avocado salad with tomatoes, delicious. Mm. Sometimes you put a hard-boiled egg in it. Lentils. I never saw a lentil other like we have here in Montana. I never saw anything there but the green or black or brown lentils.
Okay.
Which are the flat ones. They're the most common lentils.
It's so interesting that the lentil was one of the foods that you remember from childhood because that obviously ties into how you've carried out your work as a chef and community feeder here in Montana. We'll get into that in a little bit.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that I ask people is who influenced you? And I know that Mama Esco was a big influence on you and you also had an English teacher a little bit later in life that was a big influence.
Yes.
Two really powerful and wise women that seemed to give you wisdom, give you attention, give you love and care and in different ways and introduce you to things. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about those two women.
So Mama Esco, Maria Scorsia, who was the cocinera, the cook in the house, she's this black lady, you know, as old as history. I don't know. She looked ancient to me. And the color of her skin, I remember from looking at eggplants. We ate a lot of eggplants. Was like eggplant. It was like shiny black with like a purplish tint in it. And she had white kinky hair and it was always wild. And she was extremely skinny and the white uniforms never fit her. They were too big. So she would take a red dust cloth, this red big dust cloth, she would wrap it around. So at 6 o'clock in the morning or something, you would see her sweeping the little tile area, smoking her cigarette, and she had this transistor radio that was as old as she was. And then she would use like Reynolds wrap because the antenna was broken, so she would create better reception.
And what type of music was she playing?
Oh, she was playing cumbia, and cumbia is Colombian Afro music, which is pretty much all drums, and then it has a flute. So it's a combination of music of culture. So the flutes is the native, the indigenous. The drums are the African influence, and the boyera is the Spanish skirt, like the flamenco dancers. So it's a blend. You know, Mama Esco came to my life at a very important time for my formation, right? She came at a time where I was questioning a lot about my parents' separation more than before. And my aunt had 5 sons, so not that she didn't love me, but she was focusing on those 5 boys because some of them had a lot of issues going on.
Yeah, 5 boys.
Five boys, you know. And then she was also involved in all these benefits, you know. She was always helping the poor people with some organizations, working in little hospitals in the pueblos. So Mama Esco, you know, I just tended to go to the kitchen because I like food and I guess, you know, I was finding comfort in eating, right? I never saw it as an eating disorder or anything like that. I just like being there. I like the atmosphere there. I like how she allowed me to explore and how she told me stories. One of the things that she taught me was that to cook, you must feel. And that you must use your senses, and that the rice speaks to me. The rice is telling me when I must throw the water in, because we saute our rice like you make pilaf. We don't put the water and then the rice. You take the caldero, which is that pot that I serve the rice with, and we put the oil and a clove of garlic, and we let it get sizzling hot. Then we throw in the rice, and we stir it and we let it cook, and then it gets to the point where it's going, water! So she's taught me, like, I could be somewhere in the house and I'm keeping an eye at what the food on the stove is telling me to do.
Yeah.
So she taught me that. And how to use the smell, right? When is the coconut really getting to that point where you need to lower it down because it's caramelizing and it smells sweeter than it did at the beginning. And then she talks about love. That's like the last sense that you gotta put in, and good thoughts, and then you gotta have music, and it's just gotta be a wonderful experience. So That's how I cook. That's how I learn, and it made me happy, so I continued. And then she had analogies that she talked about because she knew my mom and my dad when they had better days. And she compared them to oil and vinegar. She didn't say that oil was heavier than vinegar. You know, she didn't tell me any of that. What she said is that they separate.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add a little bit of mustard or you add something and you shake it up. And she goes, and that's love. When there's love and you shake it up, it becomes one.
Gosh, I'm just like picturing you as a young girl in this kitchen with Mama Esco and like those types of stories that are passed down. I mean, I really think that's like how we learn so much more than when you're trying to learn lessons. It's like those stories and those analogies and even just watching people do a certain thing and picking up on, you know, this and that along the way. It's amazing what you even just learn by osmosis, by spending time with her.
Sometimes people ask me, can you come on and teach a class for kids? Like last summer, I taught one at Bodie Ranch. She has a kids camp. And then through Red and Spans, I met this wonderful mentor, and she asked me to come to Whitehall and to teach about lentils. And then I've asked both of them, but you've got to let me show them how to make a salad dressing.
Yeah.
And then I do the Mama Esco stuff. But I put Casey and the Sunshine Band, the sun, shake, 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 shake your booty. They're dancing, and then they taste it. Mm-hmm. They taste the oil, they taste the vinegar, they taste the jam, they taste the Dijon, and then they taste it all together.
Yeah.
And then they dance. So yeah, that really works.
Yeah. And then a little bit later in your life, you had this English teacher.
She came to my life 1971 and 1972, then she left. And those 2 years were important because I was discovering my views on life and polarities, differences in classes and racial differences. And two of my sisters moved to the United States, and my dad started sending me to Judy, which was the oldest, and Judy's 8 years older than me. And she would send me to West Virginia where she lived. And actually, this was during Watergate, talking about that they want to impeach Nixon. I don't understand a lot of what was going on. And they're protesting and they're being very active. And I'm like, I want to do that. But what happens to me is I have this desire to become a hippie. I appreciate the freeness of their way of dressing, how they don't have hang-ups if you're wearing a bra.
yeah.
If your skin is showing or not. That's just how I felt. And I see that they're speaking for the underdog.
Mm-hmm.
They're protesting the war. Why are we going to go and fight there? And all of these things. And I feel like I want to be like them. So then I go back home. And, you know, you get your new teachers for the year. And one of these is this woman, Carla Garland. And she was a graduate of UC Berkeley, an English and philosophy major. She just made some really good contrast about social classes. I never forget the story called The Necklace by Russian writer Anton Chekhov, which is very much about class in Russia. I don't know exactly how long. And she made us think. She really had us dig in. She says the writers are expressing something because it's important for them and it's important for what was happening. Mm-hmm. And it's up to us, the reader, to try to find the whys and to see what that does inside of us. So I took that very seriously.
Yeah.
You know what was going on? I did the homeworks for my friends because I was so good at it. And, you know, I'll never forget when she introduced me to Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, which then became that movie, Apocalypse Now. you know? Mm-hmm. It was based on that. It wasn't written at the same time, but, you know, the director of the movie kind of changed it. And she had us analyze those stories and of Mice and Men, John Steinbeck, you know, in California, the canneries with all the Asian people and all of these things, they were just moving me.
She lit a fire.
She lit a fire. Mama Esco lit the storytelling fire. And today, while I was looking for this book, I found my first poem. It has a lot of beauty in it. I could see Mama Esco's things because it was like the oil and vinegar, like the analogies. They were like very innocent, right?
You know, when you met this teacher, you started to read stories and read more about class systems and the structures that make up our social systems and our politics and all of that and how that affects us on a day-to-day basis and the people that we're around. Were you then kind of looking at your life and looking at people like Mama Esco, whose family has been your family for generations, but like you said, came over originally on a slave ship. And then all of these cultures mixing together to create the Colombia that you knew, that you were born into. How did that affect your view of your home country?
When I came to the States and I saw people protesting and I saw how involved they were towards the rights of other people, you know, and I remember when JFK was killed, I remember exactly what, where I was. They took us out of school. I remember all of these things, but I saw in the United States a group of people fighting for what they believed, and I didn't see that in Colombia. I saw us being complacent. Maybe it wasn't, but I was in a bilingual school that you should see how much money my parent, my dad paid for me to go to that school. And I would go to these country club dances with, you know, sequins dresses and all that. And I didn't want any of that. So to me, I always found myself that I was very close to the kitchen. I don't know what I felt besides being cared and loved. Maybe I felt like I wanted to support them. I don't know. So I wanted to leave because my way of thinking did not belong there. I told Professor Morey, who was this wonderful man who taught journalism and he taught psychology and philosophy. This is high school. I went to him and I said, Professor Morey, I love to write and I want to win an ESSO prize for Colombia. An ESSO prize is like, what do you win in the States? An Emmy Award? And then he goes, to write, you don't need to study. To write, you have to feel. You can always work on your skill. But study something that involves people, which is what moves you, and then write about it. So I didn't know. I thought I had a plan that was to study communications. And then when I went to Miami, what communications that encompasses all of these things, it's not solely just journalism. It didn't exist, so I ended up studying psychology for 2 years because I thought of my parents' issues and how it could mess me up. And then I lived in this apartment that was close to the red zone, and one day a woman ran into the little lobby of this motel that got converted into studios for students, and she had just been raped. And here I am, the psychology major, and I'm having a fit, and I don't know how to help her, so I decided to change majors. And then I turned into sociology. And when I got into the Department of Sociology and I met these teachers, and they were all men, I had had two mentors as women. And this one tells me, yes, I see why you want to change from psychology, but it's society who fucks us up. The study of sociology is going to help you, and you can write about it. And all of a sudden, everything that this little Professor Morey had been telling me, right? Study something that moves you. And if you're so moved by the social classes and all of that, study that and then write about it. But Barry Levine was the counselor in sociology, and he used the F word, and I'm like, dude, this is a cool school.
You're like, that's my guy.
I'm staying here. Look how they talk.
You go to college in Miami. You're there with your sister. of course, a lot of life experience happens, and you still are on this trajectory of fighting for a cause, fighting for, you know, wanting to change the world. And there's a disillusionment that starts to happen. Tell me a little bit about that, because that eventually leads you back to food.
So I was asked pretty much to go get a master's, which they didn't have the master's at Florida International University. I wanted to get a master's on sociology focusing on Latin America and the Caribbean. Sociology didn't have a master's. So after I ended up with two majors and like three certificates of ethnicity, Caribbean studies, minority studies, they said, okay, time to leave FIU and move somewhere else, or time to go get a job, right? So they had job fairs. So without mentioning the agency, it's an agency throughout the country which helps people. I applied for that job and I got it. My title was a program monitor. And what a program monitor does is that it goes to different service agencies. So there's service agencies for the elderly, there's for youth, as you can imagine. So I went to one of these sectors and I was supposed to look at what the grants that were written were applied for. In my case, it was meals, for example, because I ended up with a nutrition program. So, so appropriate, right? And I would have to go to these places and I would have to see, okay, it says there that they applied for funds to serve 150 meals. The 150 meals would consist, they had dietitians and everything, of X amount of protein, X amount of this, X amount of that. And then I would go to some of these places and the numbers and things were like totally off. And actually I was used, but in a positive way, because they knew I was so righteous, by an agency who kind of put the plug on me to say it like it is. Mm-hmm. And of course I have to say it like it is. And I got in trouble for saying it like it is. Actually, one of the project directors from one of the programs invited me to lunch to a very prestigious restaurant in Miami, in the Omni Hotel. And then he says, Claudia, apparently you don't know where the cookie crumbles. And I'm like, what does that mean? And he's telling me like, no.
Stop telling the truth about what's going on.
Yes. And this guy drove a Jaguar. The thing is, I was so naive that I would ask like these questions like after the report. So where is the money going? And I just couldn't live like that. I just could not be at a place where I couldn't say it like it is. So I married my wonderful husband of almost 42 years. And he said, you know what? Every day you come, all we do is talk about how unhappy you are. And every day is a story. Why don't you just quit and look for a job that you really like? So I ended up a couple of months later with a really good tan on me because I went to the pool a lot. I ended up getting a job at a wonderful hotel called the Doral Resorts of Florida. And I was hired as a training supervisor. I had no idea what a training supervisor's job was, but I knew how to write. They had me writing job descriptions, creating training manuals, and I got good at it. I did new employee orientation with a movie projector and everything, where I talked about the company. Then we went on a tour, and we ended up having lunch at the employees' cafeteria. And the employees' cafeteria was a really good benefit for the employees, because some of these employees, you know, they made the minimum wage to have lunch, and then some of them would have dinner before going home because maybe they didn't have a lot to eat at the house. But I noticed that there was like an increase of weight. The managers that I saw gained weight, a lot of stress. Mm-hmm. People that I knew drank a lot. You're around alcohol, a lot of drugs, etc. So I was already moving up the ladder in my career. I promoted myself. I would go to the general manager, Mr. Boning. How about if I become the training manager? How about if I become the training director? What if? So 10 years there, I ended up as a corporate training and development and quality assurance. I just couldn't figure out what other title that. I brought 10 different professionals from the health industry that I knew or I had been introduced, and We had one in-house in our beach hotel, a German lady. She was yoga and wellness. So we had a biofeedback person come in. We had stress management. We had a nutritionist, Carol Hopkins, from the Carol Hopkins Wellness Center. And wonderful woman about my age. And Carol, I took her to our food and beverage director, Bill Moore. And it's like, Bill, I'm so concerned about, you know, this management and the employees and the weight. So let's go to the employees cafeteria. We revise, we look at the menus, and we change tuna salad. It was like a favorite. They're loaded with mayonnaise. Reduce the mayonnaise, add crunchy, you know, celery, whatever we could add in there to bring some vegetables. And then Carol and I shared a dream of, wouldn't it be great if there would be a health food drive-thru and that you and I could design the menus? Oh man, that would be so good. So then I become pregnant and I have Gabby. I could not get pregnant, and then Gabby happens, and so I quit. But after a month or two, I'm going nuts. So I reach out to Carol. And I go, Carol, I'm going nuts. Can we do something small scale? I know we can't do the restaurant, but what can we do? So she invited me to come over and work for her and to cook for her clients in a little restaurant downstairs. Her office was up, and they had an Italian restaurant down, which was only open for dinner. So she would explain to me, so-and-sos are diabetic, so when we cook for diabetics, let's cook with these ingredients. We have cancer patients, you know, we gotta make sure that we're not giving them hormones. We gotta make sure we do this. And then we have bodybuilders. Mm-hmm. And so I said, so let's do like a healthy Stouffer's, you know, Lean Cuisines or whatever those things were. So we got our little containers, and I started just making all this food. Mm-hmm. And she had freezers upstairs, and she had three different kinds of freezers for the three categories. And she would come, the clients would come and visit with her, and then they would leave with vitamins and tons of food.
So it was like a meal prep professionally for people.
Right, and everything was vegetarian, right? Everything was vegetarian. So I learned a lot, but what was the best feeling was to see how they were getting healthy. Mm-hmm. It was hard to measure a cancer patient progress, but they felt the love, they felt the caring in the food. And I had one group that had me do the Ayurveda, and these were the couples that said, please just cook from this book, and when you get bored of these recipes, we'll buy you another. Mm-hmm. But this is the kind of food that we want to eat. Mm-hmm. So I learned about the benefits of turmeric and ginger and
all spices.
These, you know, what to eat cold and what to eat warm. And not necessarily that I eat that like that, but I respect it. And for people who believe what the philosophy is, it works for them. So I was really doing extremely well until my husband says, what if we just drop everything and we move to Montana?
You have always lived in a tropical climate, you know, for the most part. You had visited your sisters in West Virginia and Ohio, but then now you're in Montana, which is a whole different ballgame than a Miami or a Columbia.
Yeah, so you know what I haven't mentioned to you, and this is a very small part. My best friend in college is this Cuban woman, and we're still extremely good friends. She had a mother named Juanita. Juanita became Mama Esco in Miami. Yolanda lived with her parents, even though she was in college. She lived with her mom and dad until she got married. And I would go there on Saturdays, and she would make arroz con pollo, chicken and rice, and we drink beers, and we listen to Celia Cruz sing salsa. I tell Juanita, Juanita, we're moving to Montana. And I'm like, what am I gonna eat there? And then she goes, beans. Everybody eats beans. So I am a loyal client of Town and Country because it was local. And one of the things that I've always done in my life is shop locally, because that's how I grew up, going to the open markets in Barranquilla, and then to the East Coast Fisheries in Miami and Homestead for the produce. I'm like, where are the farmers here in Bozeman in 1998? I didn't see them. Mm-hmm. So I am looking for Goya black beans, because Goya is a Spanish brand and Town and Country had it, and not all black beans taste the same. And then you go and you look up, and there's these little cellophane packages, the timeless food products with a bright orangey color, little tiny like freckles, and then these yellow ones. So I'm very fascinated by these lentils, and the back says Conrad, Montana. So I am passionate about atlases and maps. That's the international relations in me. Mm-hmm. You know, just looking at geography. I love geography. And Conrad is over here. Mm. So let's look it up. And Facebook is around already. So I look it up, and Timeless has a page. And there's the CEO, David Owing. So I private message. I go, I friend him. And then we start chatting. So he's like, oh my goodness, everybody just does salads and soups. And you're making ketchup out of lentils?
So he was excited by the creativity that you were bringing to it. And you were excited because it was an organic lentil made right here in Montana.
Yes. And after a few meetings, he said, you know, they're writing a book about us. It's called The Lentil Underground. And she is a local writer from Missoula. She worked for Senator Tester. She came and did an internship here with us. I have a conference call with her, and I think it would be amazing if we proposed to her for you to write a cookbook. So Liz was just all over the idea.
Liz Carlisle.
Liz Carlisle. Liz was Michael Pollan's mentee, and asked him to be part of her dissertation. And he agreed, and the dissertation was the Montana, the Lentil Underground.
Oh, wow.
She said, you're coming to the book tour, and you're going to cook for Michael Pollan at the School of Journalism in UC Berkeley. And you're also going to teach a class at Stanford University. The last guest was Jamie Oliver, so you have a tough competition
oh my
to
goodness.
Follow. It's called the Teaching Kitchen, mm-hmm. and it's in the Department of Sustainability. And then we're also going to go to the Petaluma Seed Bank. And I said, but you need to get me a commercial kitchen because I can't cook out of this house that you want me to cook, because we got to make sure that nobody gets sick. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She says, you have to make 1,600 lentil rice. And I'm like, what? I said, oh my God. So she goes, okay, so from the recipes that you're designing for the cookbook, choose the ones that you're more passionate about and that are not too complicated. Of mm-hmm. course, I choose tamales. It's so complicated. So I did the Conrad lentil ketchup. I did timeless tamalitos, the renegade something. And then I did this little corn patties, freckled arepas. And Michael Pollan's favorite were the tamales. He loved how, he's like, because I used the yellow lentils as part of the masa, they became the wet agent. So I made soup, and then in the soup, because everything was vegan, I didn't use any animal products. So it was all coconut oil and soup, lentil soup to make the masa.
Okay.
And then I took butternut squash, mushrooms, kale, and beluga lentils and put them on the top. And then we had that with the cilantro salsa that you had mm-hmm. the other day. Mm-hmm. And he loved it. He loved it. And it was an amazing experience. And to be at UC Berkeley and to see Janis Joplin picture.
Home of all the hippies.
I made it to hippie land, yes.
What year was this?
2016. So we're there for like a week. Then Liz, she has her book tour in her state. So she asked me to go to Missoula, which is her hometown, and I taught a couple of classes at the Good Food Store there. Mm. I'm asked to go to farm tours and cook. So Davis, can you come to Ulm? Can you come to Haver? Can you come to Fort Benton, to all these places? Because we're promoting the book, and this is the home of these farmers. Sure thing. Get me some lentils. And I recreate the same dishes that we did for the tasting. So I come back with 25-pound bags of lentils. And some of them are not in a bag, they're in 5-gallon buckets, you know?
I have over 400 pounds of lentils in the house, which I still have because I keep asking for more, and I'll tell you why in a minute. So I'm working on the recipes, and my family loves it, but at one point, it's like when Gabby was little, no mas, mommy, no more. Mm-hmm. Stevie's like, no more. My dogs were eating lentil bites.
Oh, God.
So what am I going to do with all these lentils? I met Rick Boss, the author, and he says, well, why don't you come to one of my workshops? And he says, I have one in October in Troy. So I signed up for it. I went, and on the way back, I'm listening to Francis Lam in the Splendid Table, and he's doing a whole thing about musicians, and they jam, and after the jam, they just eat, and, you know, and if there's people that have been listening to the music and they walk in, you know, it's free dinner for the little community in the French Quarter or whatever. And I'm like, oh, a free dinner for my community. Wouldn't that be amazing? Because I always wanted to be part of community, and, you know, in my sociology, that's the strength of a society and mm-hmm. how strong your community is. So I say, what a great way to bring them together. So I share the idea with Dave, and he says, you need more lentils? So he calls them lentils. What I need you is to be my guest.
Yeah.
And to be my first guest of the lentil table. So he was my first guest. And I made a pizza, because we were at, I had a private dining room at Red Tractor Pizza. So Adam made me the shell, and I made a harissa, a black goddess hummus. It was absolutely delicious. And David spoke. So the plan is for the next one. And another guest is bringing somebody else from the community. So I brought somebody from the Bozeman film, because I love film too. Mm-hmm. And then I brought Doug from Mozambique to talk about his project with Cuba. Then I bought Gallatin Valley Farm to School. Then I bought farmers, and it was just trying to introduce a community to smaller people that were doing amazing things, but mm-hmm. not everybody knows about them. Mm-hmm. And it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
And where I met you this past summer was at Eagle Mount.
Yes.
And there were over 100 people there.
Yep. I had 135 people paid. I don't know if they all showed up because it was such a wide space.
Yeah, and it was outside, so it was hard to tell.
And it was outside, and it was COVID, and it was so wonderful to have it because it was, you know, last year was a tough year.
Yeah, yeah, so, to bring people together. So your tagline for your current company, mm-hmm. Claudia's Mesa, is One World, One Table.
Yes.
What are you trying to do when you bring people together and you're feeding them, but you're bringing them to the same table?
Well, one of the wonderful things about lentils is that, number one, it's historic, that it's a biblical staple, that it dates all the way back when it was called Mesopotamia, and that it has survived centuries, and that it's this legume, this adorable little tiny thing that doesn't ask for much, but it gives so much, right? And what I love about lentils is that they can have many flags, but they don't have barriers. They don't build separation. So you can dress a lentil up mm-hmm. in any color that mm-hmm. you want. It takes spices so well. So One World, One Table is that lentil table featuring that lentil with all these different flags, and knowing that if we break bread together, we are one. We become one at the table. Mm-hmm. So it's like King Arthur's round table, but here we have an infinite number of tables, or there are no tables. We're just mm-hmm. breaking bread. Mm-hmm. So it's somos uno en la mesa, means we are one at the table. To make it shorter, because that's too long, One World, One Table. It's carrying that message that, you know, it's okay to be different. It's okay to have different religious beliefs or no religious beliefs at all. That people are good
Yeah.
Everybody has something good that we should be looking at that good. It's just like when I was little, I hated eggplant. But that's because Mama Esco didn't know how to cook an eggplant. But then when I visited my friends from Israel, man, can they cook an eggplant.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's so much to learn being curious and what do we have to teach each other and share with each other.
We lose our naivete. We lose our innocence. And I haven't lost mine. And I want to instill a little bit of innocence, because when we're innocent, we don't care about color. We don't care about status. We don't care about anything. We just want to play. In my case, I just want to eat and share.
It seems like your whole life you have had this fire and this passion for change and for helping people. You've gone through different phases of what that looks like and what role you play in the change that you know, not to be cliche, but the change that you want to see in the world.
Well, there's a lot of things that are starting to become more clear. I don't celebrate New Year in the way of New Year's resolution. I celebrate my birthday because it's a new year for me, and my birthday was just in November. And everything has kind of coming to place right now. I'm at the verge of signing a two-year contract with the Montana Department of Agriculture, the Pulse Crop Division. And my mission is, I am an ambassador for the Montana Pulse Crops in Latin America. We created an initiative called Hola Montana, which is linking our Montana producers with, for now, Colombia, because it's where I'm from and I have connections there to make those introductions, to create a link so that we can provide more opportunities for our growers and at the same time provide a wholesome food for our people in Colombia, especially people with lower economic needs. And it's not just bringing the lentils to a market like Supertienda Olímpica, which is like a top like Kroger or anything, but it's taking it to the little tiendas. There's more people in that market than there are in the big ones. To make sure that the Montana lentils are growing to that tienda in that little pueblito where Mama Esco grew up, which is called Palenque, and they're getting 12 grams of protein in a quarter cup of uncooked lentils, which becomes a half a cup of cooked lentils, that you buy for very minimal price. So imagine how good that feeling is, so that we can create this relationship. And at the same time, we want to bring those people to where the magic is. We want to take them to the farms, because they've been buying lentils from Canada. And not that we don't like our neighbors, but why go there when you got us, right? So we're establishing that relation. My job is to create content for Hola Montana, to go there, to cook, to connect our growers with people that I know there, and then to return the trip. But I also want to expand my lentil table. And I'm going to apply for a grant, and maybe I don't get it because it has never been given to an individual. It has been given to, like, the Department of Agriculture. So I'm going to the USDA and asking for a grant for us, meaning the lentil table, so that I can take the lentil table throughout Montana, because I want to introduce Montanans to Montanans like I did when I created the Lentil Caravan with funds from the Red Ants Pants Foundation. I traveled the state and I went to schools and to women's clubs and the boys clubs, you know, all those YMCAs. I want to make it self-sufficient so that I don't have to go, but they start carrying their own little communities themselves. Mm-hmm. I have good friends like Sarah Calhoun of Red Ants Pants. She's like, you can count on us at White Sulphur Springs. I have the Manuels in Haver. So I already have these connections of farmers and of great people so that we could do that. And I also am writing again. So I'm working on two books. One of them is a cookbook with stories from the other book. And that's going to continue carrying the story, the lentil story. And then revamping my spice line.
That's right.
Which is going to be renamed to names of countries and flavors, so that's going to be the passport for the lentils. We're going to see if I can get with another organization that we can make like soups with the spices, so that we can send this to certain communities, to reservations, so that we can help people in Montana eat better.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One of the threads that I have heard just as you've talked is this idea of needing to feel. Mama Esco told you, in order to cook, you need to feel. Mm-hmm. And your counselor said, in order to write, you need to feel. Mm-hmm. And so much of what you are doing in building community and networking and bringing people together is, from my perspective, helping people to feel and helping people to use their senses and to eat and to talk to each other and to have emotions about what it feels like to be together. When it's all said and done, you have this very special relationship with how you feel about lentils as this universal symbol of nourishment and of compassion and of nutrition and all of these things that you believe the lentils to be. So I want to ask you to speak to the lentils and tell them how you feel. What would you say?
You know the corny song from Flashdance, What a Feeling? I can have it all. I'm grateful because they have made me have it all.
They really have.
When I'm at my lentil table, I'm a ham. I love the camera. I'll pose. I don't care how I look. I got people looking at me. And they have my attention. And then I have music going on. And then I have food that people are eating. And then I'm looking around once the speeches are done, and I'm seeing this group, and they're having fun, and they're eating, and I'm seeing the little kid dancing, and I'm like, it's all because of you. Mm-hmm. If I didn't have the lentils, they're the reason that I've been able to express myself. It's my language. So what a feeling, man, I get.
Claudia, a vibrant and brilliant woman who I am so happy to know. Since we met this summer, I've learned that a friendship with her guarantees delicious food, hip-shaky music, conversations about culture, people, history, literature, oneness, and meditation. That sharing what you know and giving your gifts and service to others is a special type of fulfillment that I think we all long for, and I've learned from her how that can ease into well-being in all of the ways. Claudia lives with such a childlike wonder and curiosity, and her ability to relate to many different people and places has inspired me to keep learning, keep putting myself out there, and trust that it's not only safe to be open to others, but it's a hell of a lot more rewarding and adventurous. Seeing Claudia's collaboration around town and her aspirations to bring the lentil table to rural Montana is amazing, and I hope to help support her in her ventures and tag along for the ride as long as I'm here. If you also want to tag along for the ride and support her ventures, you can learn more about Claudia and her offerings at claudiasmesa.com and olamontana.com. A special thank you to Matthew Marsalek and the Drum Brothers, whose music you hear at the beginning and end of this podcast, as well as Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolin, who first turned us on to the phenomenon of the Dandelion Effect and how ideas move through the world. This podcast is a production of the Feather Pipe Foundation, a 501c3 dedicated to healing, education, community, and empowerment. If you'd like to help support this project, please visit featherpipe.com/gratitude and leave a review on Apple Podcasts and share with your friends and family. Be sure to tune in to our next episode in 2 weeks. I cannot wait to share another amazing conversation with you. Until then, have a beautiful day.